Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good day. Welcome to New Books in History, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. My name is Dr. Charles Cutillo of the Royal Historical Society. I'm a host on the channel. And today I'm pleased to have with us Mr. Michael Kluger and Mr. Richard Evans. And today we are speaking about their book, Roosevelt and Churchill, The Atlantic Charter, A Risky Meeting at Sea That Saved Democracy, published by the Naval Institute Press. Welcome, gentlemen.
Good to be with you.
Good to be with you. Thank you.
Gentlemen, why did you write this book?
I think Michael ought to answer that because it was his idea.
The United States of America and Great Britain have had what is referred to as a special relationship. It has been in place for many, many years. And there's always been an undercurrent in U.S. foreign relations of sort of an America first alternative approach to the United States' role in the world. And that America first to me is an anathema, and it had been gaining momentum without getting into specific politicians or politics. It just was gaining momentum at the expense of what I consider to be the special relationship. And to me, the Atlantic Charter, the Atlantic Conference, was as strong a example of how effective that special relationship could be and has been to the world and to, of course, the two nations involved, that I thought it was a good way to highlight things. And in my opinion, both the charter and the conference are not appreciated for what those two leaders did in very dark times under challenging circumstances to move forward and put some very important ideas in front of the world. And so it's a reminder of both the relationship and the leadership of the two gentlemen.
Whose idea initially was this meeting, risky meeting at sea, as you characterize it?
Yeah, I think that FDR, on his side, working through Harry Hopkins, felt that so much could be achieved if Churchill and FDR could get together face to face. FDR surfaced the idea with his Secretary of Commerce, who was his main intermediary between himself and Winston Churchill, and they spent time. Hopkins visited London, and Winston Churchill was, I wouldn't use the word desperate to get the United States into the war with his battle with Nazi Germany, but he certainly was determined to do so. So it was a great, great opportunity for Winston Churchill, and I think Churchill's view was without the United States entering the war, the prospect of defeating Germany was going to be much, much harder. He did have a plan for defeating Germany and Nazi Germany, but it made a lot more sense with the United States by his side. So hence the meeting for taking place.
Yes, to embellish on that, what Michael has just said, maybe I could read just one sentence from the introduction, because Churchill was desperate to meet Roosevelt, and he took an enormous risk in jumping on his battleship and heading across the Atlantic, which was infested with U-boats. And the Canadian Prime Minister, Mackenzie King, was very critical of it. And he said there was, they can communicate perfectly well, and they don't have to put everybody's lives at risk in doing so. But the paragraph I want to read you goes like this. It was hard to argue with King. His appraisal of the meeting's circumstances was accurate, but buried in his assertions was a false claim. The essence of everything these two leaders would achieve together in the coming years would, in fact, stem from the irreplaceable act of personal contact, the look in the eye, the toast at dinner, the cigar and the cigarette late at night, the sizing up of one man's mood, fears, and ambitions face to face.
Now, there was a prior meeting or a first meeting between Roosevelt and Churchill back in 1918, in which was not from the perspective of friendliness, was not a successful meeting. Roosevelt apparently expressed some dissatisfaction with Churchill as a person at that meeting. What was the particulars of that dissatisfaction?
Well, honestly, Richard, you might be aware of that. I'm not. I do note that FDR honestly did not even remember meeting Churchill. That's what we write in our book. It took place, obviously, as you said, World War One. They were very different gentlemen. They both had naval backgrounds. FDR was... in his role as Secretary of the Navy, just in life. But at this juncture, when they met, Churchill was chagrined to find out that FDR didn't even really remember the meeting. So I wouldn't have put great faith in that. It wasn't like they knew each other quite well at that time.
It was a brief and chance meeting that didn't go well. It didn't, you know, it had no effect on anything, really.
What were the...
I was going to say, in advance of this particular meeting, the two gentlemen had been corresponding for several years in advance, and they had gotten to know each other through the written correspondence as well as some periodic telephone calls, which were rather scratchy and difficult. But they were already well acquainted from that standpoint, but they had never actually met.
Yep. And Churchill was, he was a little tough to call it desperate, but he knew that if he didn't get real help in armaments and support from the United States, Britain would simply not be able to hold out for very much longer. And that is why he took this risk of sailing across the Atlantic to try and form a relationship that he could persuade Roosevelt, which of course he didn't do. The meeting was incredibly important and useful, but he did not, in August 1941, persuade Roosevelt to join Britain in World War II. It would probably have come to that eventually, but of course what made it happen suddenly was Pearl Harbor. And from Britain's point of view, that was a godsend.
Now, you make reference to the correspondence which commenced, I believe, in September 1939. Whose idea was that, given the fact that it was a little bit unusual for a head of state, head of government, to write to on a consistent basis to a minister in another country's government?
Richard, I don't know if you have an answer to that. What I would say is that I do not. There are people who have much greater knowledge of the background of both Churchill and Roosevelt, and our focus really was on this particular meeting. So I can take you through my background. Richard can take you through his background. I do know that there are some very wonderfully published book series on that capture all of their correspondence, and I would just go to chapter one and look at the first letter. Richard, you may
know. Yes, I think that the one must remember that before Churchill became prime minister in May, Chamberlain had brought him back into the government, and so he was back at the Admiralty, and that is where the connection came, because Roosevelt, as we mentioned and pointed out, was Assistant Secretary of the Navy, so his background was naval. And he obviously wanted to keep in touch with what was happening across the Atlantic. And the man I think he felt he could best communicate with was a former Lord of the Admiralty and a man who had been reappointed as First Lord of the Admiralty. So that's how the connection was made. And they just continued from there. And Churchill, in his whimsical way, always signed his communiques a former naval person once he became prime minister, and that tickled Roosevelt's sense of humor, I think.
Now, what was the origins of the document that we call the Atlantic Charter?
So they, on the first night of the meeting at sea, August 9, 1941, Churchill and FDR, along with Harry Hopkins, Lord Cadogan, Summer Wells, they sat around after a very formal dinner and shared some ideas. And it was left, it was FDR's suggestion that Churchill prepare a first draft, which was done. And we actually have a copy of the very first draft of the charter with Winston Churchill's handwritten notes, and so they talked about it. FDR wanted to have it. Churchill leapt at the idea, and I think FDR was very smart to let Churchill write the first draft and present the first draft.
Yes, thanks to Alan Packwood at Cambridge University Churchill College, who is the number one archivist as for all things Churchill and the real expert. He was kind enough to let me into the archive center at Churchill College, which is like getting into Fort Knox, and having signed all the papers, and this was before COVID, so it was easier than it would have been now. But I was able to see a lot of documents and actually handle this typewritten bit of paper, which a gentleman called McKinnor had typed out on his big black typewriter on this rolling battleship in the Atlantic, the original 8 points of the Atlantic Charter, with Churchill's correction in red ink. And it was quite a thrill to be able to see this. But that was the document, and we print that in the book. And that laid out the principles for how nations should interact with each other and in a civilized world, and communicate and take into account each other's differences, but not let it get to the point of war. I suppose you could say that was the idea behind the United Nations, and there's no question that the Atlantic Charter laid some kind of a foundation for later, a few years later after the war, the creation of the United Nations. So although the Atlantic Charter didn't itself become that well known, and in fact some people were disappointed that it didn't go further, it laid these important foundations for the future harmony between nations.
Now, why do you, in the book, give chapter-long biographies of various dramatic personae that we read about?
Well, I mean, the book, besides the organization of the book, is not just the actual meeting, but and the charter itself and what happened during the conference. But we found that there were a handful of players who were integral to the formation of the charter and how the conference went, and we decided to do descriptive histories of those individuals, where they came from, how they came to be at the conference, and their background. So it's sort of how we approach the book.
Yes, I think it's important to bring to today's public the fact that the supporting cast was pretty important, and some of them are very well known historically, like Lord Beaverbrook, but and to an extent Harry Hopkins, Sumner Wells, Sir Alexander Cadogan, but there were others like Wilfred Freeman, who actually had far more to do with getting the Spitfire and the Hurricane manufactured than Beaverbrook did, because he was an ex-First World War pilot and a bit of a hero, and he knew how to put together a plane and fly it. And while Beaverbrook banged the drum in his usual bombastic style to get everybody working hard and producing these planes, which were so vital to the eventual victory of the Battle of Britain, it was Freeman who did the hard work, and he's almost completely unknown to history. So we hope that giving him a chapter brings a new personality into this whole incredible story of how Britain survived in 1939-40 with Hitler and his Nazis camped right across the Channel.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Overall, what does one make of Roosevelt as a personal and political animal? Do you agree with the famous American historian Richard Hofstadler's characterization of Roosevelt as, quote, the patricianist opportunist, unquote?
Well, again, Richard, you might want to say something about that. Great respect for Hofstadter, but I'd rather stay away from commenting on it. Just, I personally don't feel that I've got the background to say this, that, or the other. I do think.
I didn't get the question. Could you repeat the question?
Of course. Overall, what does one make of Roosevelt as a personal and political animal? Do you agree with the famous American historian Richard Hoff?
What I would say is FDR was the exact opposite of Winston Churchill. Winston Churchill was what you see is what you got. He didn't really mince words in many situations. FDR was inscrutable. He was very Machiavellian in how he communicated with both friends and foes, was very, very careful in his use of words and relationships. So, I think there's, Hofstadter describes it in a dark way. I describe it as he was just very shrewd. And he was president of the United States in the middle of a depression and then into a world war. And I think he had traits that he had used through his whole life that served him well in those crises. It was his style. He was not a Mr. Slap Your Back, bubbly kind of politician. He was very inscrutable, very, very careful about the relationships he chose, the words he used, and the things he supported and the things he opposed. I just don't want to say it was a dark side of him. He was just very, very thoughtful, careful, and Machiavellian.
I think the playwright who was brought into the White House at the beginning of the war to write speeches, etc., Robert Sherwood, came up with the phrase that epitomized FDR when he referred to his forested interior and fighting your way through that forested interior to find out exactly what he was thinking, when he himself admitted that he often didn't know what his right hand was doing in relationship to his left hand, I think sort of says it.
What would have occurred if Harry Hopkins had not been Roosevelt's emissary to Churchill, but instead Sumner Wells? Would it have made any difference to history?
Well, I think Harry Hopkins, who is known as a great in-betweener, had remarkable talents and skills. And, nothing against Sumner Wells. FDR found that Sumner Wells was someone who would agree with him readily, whereas Harry Hopkins was more of a bosom buddy. I think that FDR felt the relationship he needed to have with both Churchill, needed someone that he absolutely trusted, and that was Harry Hopkins. And I think while FDR appreciated Sumner Wells and got along well with him and had confidence in him, the role that Harry Hopkins played throughout throughout Roosevelt's presidency was unique and irreplaceable.
Yes, I think Harry Hopkins is really one of the sort of great tragic heroes of history, because he was a desperately unwell man. He'd had an operation on his stomach and had half his stomach cut away sometime in the late 30s. And he traveled to Moscow on FDR's behalf, and then crucially to London to meet Churchill, and needed to rest up in his hotel before he could gather himself to go to his first dinner or lunch, I think it was. It spread on for hours, number 10 Downing Street. And he was obviously a man of great fortitude. And I hope that historians will get something out of our chapter on Harry Hopkins in this book, because he was a huge factor. I mean, we talk about the need for Churchill and Roosevelt to understand each other and get to like each other and become friends. But the initial contact was made when FDR sent Harry Hopkins across the Atlantic. And if Hopkins and Churchill had hated each other on sight, it would have made life exceedingly more difficult than it was. But they didn't. They hit it off absolutely with the first glass of wine. And by the time they got to the brandy at the end of this four-hour meal, they'd become friends. And the visit to Britain by Harry Hopkins was supposed to last a matter of days. In the end, Churchill ended up taking him all over the country. And Hopkins stayed in Britain for over 2 weeks and went back to FDR and said, despite everything you've heard about him being a drunk and being unreliable, the only person you need to deal with in Britain is Churchill, because he is in full command of the entire operation.
Why was General Marshall, as you put it, quote, the most powerful man in the USA after Roosevelt, unquote?
Well, his job was to get the United States prepared for World War II. FDR knew it was coming. And, we know of George Marshall today as the Marshall Plan, but this was much earlier, so it was not as well known, obviously, and he had a major role, but he was pulling the armed forces together and was very integral to preparedness for World War II.
Yeah, he was the ultimate staff officer. He was the antithesis of a Patton. He never really saw action and probably didn't become as famous because of that. But he was a master planner. He could organize everything that was needed to be organized, and he had this quiet, commanding personality that enabled him to run everything on FDR's behalf. And probably the assessment was accurate. He was probably the second most important man in America.
Why was Roosevelt's relations with Sumner Welles better than Roosevelt's relations with Secretary of State Hull?
Well, first of all, Cordell Hull had been ill and been really away from his office for several months, and had just returned to fulfilling his duties as Secretary of State, and I suspect he wasn't yet 100%. And so the conference taking place at sea, it was perfect excuse for Roosevelt to basically not invite Cordell Hull to the conference itself. Instead, Sumner Welles was asked as undersecretary. Interestingly enough, Roosevelt had two of his sons at the Atlantic Conference as well, and one of his sons asked the question, gee, why is Sumner here? And FDR's response was, because he'll do what I say, versus Cordell Hull, who had his own agenda on many issues, and it was a much more challenging relationship.
Yes, it was a family background thing as well, to an extent. Sumner Welles had been involved with the Roosevelts. His family had been involved with the Roosevelts in New York City as part of society, and they went to each other's weddings, and they'd known each other their entire lives, whereas Cordell Hull was not of that social class. And I just think, reading between the lines, FDR felt so much more comfortable in the company of Sumner Welles.
How did the British react to Sumner Welles' peace mission of the spring of 1940?
So, again, that's one. Richard, you might have some information about it. I don't. We leave that to others. It's just not something that I have strong comments about.
Could you repeat the question? I'm not hearing you very clearly.
How did the British react to Sumner Welles' peace mission of the spring of 1940?
Peace mission with who?
Between the different powers who were at war at that point in March 1940. He made a trip to Europe where he went to the UK, Germany, and Italy, as well as France.
Well, I mean, Churchill was besieged by people within his own government, led by his only rival for the premiership, Lord Halifax, of wanting to talk peace, wanting to talk to Mussolini, wanting to try yet again, although Chamberlain had failed and failed and failed, to get Hitler to behave in a civilized manner. And Churchill had seen right through this. He'd been telling people for years, and in fact, his son, Randolph, at the age of 21, in the chapter at the end of the book, had been telling the world in his written articles for British newspapers that war was inevitable because the generals were so furious still about the Treaty of Versailles that they would urge Hitler to gain revenge, whatever happened. That was a 21-year-old writing from Berlin in 1930. And the father, Churchill, was completely in agreement. He felt that there was absolutely no way you could deal with a man of Hitler's character, and that if you gave an inch, he would grab a mile, and that he rebuffed all these attempts to make peace agreements, and that included Sumner Welles and included Halifax. Chamberlain was out of the picture by then, of course, because Churchill was prime minister, but it was a one-man show. Without Churchill, Hitler would have come to some agreement with Britain, and the future would have been just the total opposite to how it turned out. Hitler would have grabbed everything that he could have grabbed, and eventually he would have taken over Britain. So it really was a one-man show. Without Churchill, the history of the world would be totally different.
Would it be true to say that Sir Alexander Cadogan, the permanent Undersecretary of State at the Foreign Office, was, could we say, the father of the Atlantic Charter?
Well, I don't think he was the father of it, but he certainly had a great deal to do with the writing of it, along with Sumner Wells. I think it was the two leaders, FDR to begin with, saying we want to come out with some kind of document or statement as a result of this meeting. Churchill leaping at that, saying, yes, it's necessary, we have to. And I think they were the fathers of the document, although the actual writing of it was certainly done to a large degree by Cadogan. Sitting side by side at some stage on their battleships and cruisers with Sumner Wells. So it was very much a team effort.
Now, why did you include a chapter on Randolph Churchill in the book, since he was not at the meeting?
But this was my decision, and Michael wasn't necessarily thrilled about the idea, but I think... Randolph Churchill had a far greater impact on his father than anybody imagines. And he, throughout Winston Churchill's life, as soon as Randolph became an adult, he was receiving advice and sometimes great direction from Randolph Churchill, and who was, of course, a exceedingly difficult character. He was a drunk, and he was abusive, and he was hated by a lot of people who he insulted. And that is his image, and it's a bit of a tragedy. And I read his son, Winston Jr.'s book, who I knew. I covered Chicago 68 with Winston Jr. And I read his book, and I thought, this man was brilliant. And the great historian, Trevor Roper, said that there was no greater political analyst during that period, the 1940s and 50s, than Randolph Churchill. And extraordinarily, Winston Churchill wrote to Clementine, his wife, and saying, I have always been in full admiration of Randolph's ability to stand up and speak off the cuff. And Churchill wrote his speeches, and if he didn't read them, he memorized them. And he wasn't a natural off-the-cuff speaker. But watching his son, Randolph, perform on hustings and in Parliament for a time, Winston wrote to his wife and said, I'm going to try this. I'm going to try and copy Randolph and just speak off the cuff. And that led, obviously, his great speeches that we all know were written and worked on. But he took the confidence to speak off the cuff from his son. And that was just, we relate in the chapter, numerous occasions when Randolph had an influence on his father. And I just wanted to take this opportunity. He didn't go to the Atlantic Conference, but he was involved in his father's life to a far greater extent than anybody realizes.
Well, I would add that I relented a bit just because the man was so misunderstood. He was also extremely brave. Winston Churchill sent him to reside with Tito and the partisans in what eventually became Yugoslavia, with the objective of to tie down as many Nazi troops looking to capture him as possible, as a way to take the pressure off other parts of the battlefield as far as the British were concerned. And Randolph did that very bravely. There's the book that Richard's referring to, written by Winston S. Churchill, his father's son, which is the book of Winston S. Churchill wrote about his father, Randolph. It's a wonderful, wonderful statement. And the man's just so misunderstood. Why not put a chapter in, since the book has chapters about all sorts of people who influenced and or helped both Churchill or FDR?
Just as a matter of history, interesting little tidbit, the city of Trieste, which sits on the Italian northern border, would have been Yugoslavia had it not been for Randolph Churchill. He knew exactly, he'd come to know Tito through having fought with him in the hills of Yugoslavia, and he warned his father that if they didn't deploy troops into Trieste, Tito would grab it and take it over. So everybody who's been living in Trieste for the last several decades should know that it was Randolph Churchill who stopped them being Yugoslavs.
What is for you the chief legacy of the Atlantic Charter?
Yeah, okay. I don't know if Michael's still there, but the chief legacy of the Atlantic Charter is that it did lay the foundations for the United Nations, the principles by which countries should interact between each other in a civilized fashion. Obviously, the tenets of the Atlantic Charter have been broken tragically in various places. We've been talking about Yugoslavia, Bosnia being one of the prime examples. But it laid this foundation from which people work later. And it was an important moment in history because it was desperately necessary that America and Britain came to some basic understanding to work together. If FDR had not been willing to listen to Churchill and act in the ways that he was able to, given the fact that there was a huge Republican movement against any kind of involvement in World War II, he allowed the convoys to go across the Atlantic, sending much needed supplies to Britain, and guarded them with the U.S. Navy. And he made all these gestures before America was pulled into the war that was based on their conversations while they were creating the Atlantic Charter on their ships of war off the coast of Newfoundland. And it was really a moment in history that we felt needed to be spotlighted, because I know Michael has too. We've asked so many people, what do you know about the Atlantic Charter? And they say, oh, I think I've heard of that. And that sort of distant look comes into their eye. And people don't really know much about it. But it was a totally pivotal moment in history between the two greatest leaders of the 20th century.
Yeah, I mean, one could argue, as Prime Minister of Canada did, that much of the planning that took place probably could have been done without face-to-face meetings. But the two things that clearly came out of the Atlantic Conference that would have not happened had the meeting not taken place was, one, the strengthening and the depth of the relationship between Churchill and Roosevelt on a personal level. And secondly, the charter itself, 8 simple points, one of which was an agreement to defeat Nazism, but which is no longer required. But the other 7 points, as you look through them, slightly over 200 words in aggregate, I do believe are very important guides for how civilized nations should act and have, and not every nation, not every time, but since the joint proclamation, both Churchill and FDR releasing the document to the world at the same time. It's not a treaty, it's not signed, but just releasing it, I think the free-speaking nations of the world have held each other accountable on most occasions to the behavior of those of the points in the charter. And as much that the charter has been lost and not relished as much as the ideas, is as much the motivation for writing the book as anything.
On that observation, gentlemen, I would like to thank you very much for being so kind as to speak with us today. This is Charles Cotillo. Thanks for listening to New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Thank you, gentlemen, both very much.
Thank you.